This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's how you know things are screwy on Wall Street. The Fed released the minutes of its latest meeting today. The major indices promptly went south because traders didn't much like what they heard. The dollar dropped too, and oil prices rose a lot, which sent the markets back up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health and reduced costs for business, aafp.org/value, and by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 20th of November, and it's great to have you with us. Let me see if I can pick up the thread here and make sense of the day that was for you. Going in, it looked like one of those, not great, but not terrible either kinds of days. There were some murmurings about subprimes, which we'll get to in a minute, but the main event for everybody was the Federal Reserve. I told you last week that Chairman Ben Bernanke's decided to pull back the veil a little bit and let the rest of us in on which way the Fed thinks the economy's going and what that might mean for interest rates, a topic near and dear, of course, to Wall Street's heart. To start things off, Marketplace's Bob Moon's been reading the minutes of the latest meeting for us. Hiya, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
Let me make sure I am reading these tea leaves right. What we have on the one hand is Wall Street not outright begging for a rate cut, but as close as Wall Street's going to get. On the other hand, what we have the Fed here saying today, if I'm right, is maybe not so fast.
That's right. I'm not saying the Fed put the chance of another interest rate cut on ice, but the temperature did turn noticeably chilly on Wall Street just about the time that this new economic assessment came out. The Dow was actually in positive territory, and it didn't take much more than a few minutes for investors to kind of speed read through the minutes of the last monetary policy meeting and figure out that there's a big disconnect between what the markets have been anticipating and what the country's central bankers have been saying behind closed doors. The analysts have been telling us, as you mentioned, that the market's already been pricing in an interest rate cut in December. It turns out Wall Street came much closer than investors realized to not even getting that second rate cut last month.
Well, don't keep us waiting here, man. What are they saying about a future rate cut?
Good question. The record of what went on at last month's meeting shows that the policymakers debated intensely whether they should wait for more evidence of damage from the housing slump and the market turmoil and all that before deciding where rates should go. And while most members decided it was wise to buy themselves what you might call some economic insurance here, the minutes say that that was a very close call. You could say that we're now a month beyond that, that that's history, that things change. But as we've mentioned here in recent days, several of these policymakers have been sending strong signals just lately that the two cuts they've made are probably going to be enough.
Yeah, just to add to the confusion for a second here, they did actually use the word fragile, talking about the financial sector, right?
That's right. That doesn't necessarily mean that these two rate cuts that they've already done won't take care of that.
Yeah. Last time we talked about this last week, we addressed the issue of the economic forecast that the Fed is going to give. Was that a whole lot of sound and fury, or is there actually something interesting in what they had to say today?
there's really not much in there to tip the Fed's hand one way or the other here. It's expecting slow economic growth, slightly higher unemployment, and moderate inflation. Well, that sounds pretty much on balance to me in terms of the Fed's comfort zone.
So, basically.
Yeah, basically, we don't know.
Yeah, all right, good. Bob Moon, our senior business correspondent. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
By the time the closing bell rang today, the major indices had gotten back all they lost thanks to the Fed and then some. The pieces came together like this. After the Fed said the economy is going to slow next year, the dollar tumbled to a record low against the euro. That bumped oil prices up since it is traded in the ever-weakening greenback. Higher crude means good things for oil companies. ExxonMobil led the Dow back up today. It gained more than 4%. Quite the opposite came to pass, though, for some key players in the housing market. Freddie Mac announced this morning it lost $2 billion last quarter. Its shares plummeted almost 29%. D.R. Horton, the country's biggest home builder, said it lost $50 million in the same period. And pity the poor press officer at Countrywide. The mortgage lender spent the day denying bankruptcy rumors. And then there's this. Earnings at the nation's savings and loans have plunged. Yeah, that's right. Mortgage problems. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay explains.
Investors piled into savings and loan stocks in August. Back then, they looked like a safe haven from the subprime mess. Scott Polakoff is the chief operating officer at the Office of Thrift Supervision. He says SNL earnings fell 84% in the third quarter.
It's been a long time since we've seen that kind of drop, almost 15 or 16 years ago.
Polakoff says large thrifts who sell mortgages to investors took some of the biggest losses. They had to write down some of the mortgages on their books when they couldn't sell the loans.
You have a pipeline of loans that you put into inventory before you sell. As the secondary market liquidity seized up, the prices for those loans fell. Not the credit quality, but the prices for those loans fell. That caused institutions who hold those loans for sale to have to adjust them.
Those secondary markets still haven't recovered. But regulators say the big thrifts that rely on them are still flush with cash. Bob Davis is with America's Community Bankers. It represents the thrift industry. He says most thrifts don't use the secondary market. They keep the loans they make on their books. He says the vast majority of the nation's 800 SNLs are fine.
Probably that decline of profitability has nothing to do with your local institution, particularly if it's a community bank.
Still, the OTF's Polakoff says thrift execs think the housing market will get worse. They've diverted money away from this year's profits to cover future mortgage defaults. Over the next 12 to 18 months, some consumers may find it a lot harder to get a loan. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
When you have to follow business news every day, believe me when I tell you, you do everything you can to make it interesting. And we found a keeper today, something called the Baltic Exchange Dry Sea Freight Index. It's a measure of global cargo shipment, although without oil included, since crude shipments vary quite a bit. Anyway, so far this year, the index is up nearly 150%, which is kind of a surprise, given all the gloomy talk about the credit crunch and a slowing U.S. economy. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale discovered the index does reveal some global economic growth that's being generated in new places.
It used to be the U.S. and Europe, with a little help from Japan, were the locomotives pulling the global economy. During the last U.S. recession, the Baltic Exchange gauge of world cargo shipments lost almost half its value. Now, even though shipments into U.S. ports are declining, the index hit an all-time high this month. India and China are now doing the pulling, and demand from new consumers there could help the U.S. avoid a recession, says Matt Slaughter at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth.
More centers of economic growth create the opportunity for one or more of those centers to pull along demand growth throughout the world if other centers seem to falter a bit.
The weak dollar makes U.S. products cheaper overseas, and that's another reason exports from Long Beach, California, the world's busiest port, jumped by a third in October, according to the Baltic Exchange. But David Rothkopf, a former trade official in the Clinton administration, warns economic interdependence works two ways.
You've found irrational exuberance in U.S. real estate markets, and as that's becoming unwound, if that brings down U.S. consumer confidence, if we stop buying as many Chinese and Indian products, if they start seeing the consequences of that in their economy, and all of a sudden people head for the exits in their stock markets, then we've got a real problem.
The other looming problem is inflation. Rapidly developing countries are soaking up commodities from around the world, driving those prices up for everyone. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Whipsaw would be a good way to describe the markets today. Just plain crazy might be another. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There have been two key sticking points in the discussion over stem cells. Where would the cells come from, and who would put up the money? Until now, there's been just one source, human embryos. But the news today that scientists have been able to make stem cells from plain old skin cells could change the terms of the financial debate. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
It used to be that scientists who wanted to conduct embryonic stem cell research had to get the cells from a human embryo. What these Japanese and American researchers did instead was take skin cells and reprogram or modify them so that they act like embryonic stem cells. That means theoretically, if the cells are used to, say, repair damaged heart tissue, your immune system would accept them because they'd be your own cells. Dr. Robert Lonza with Advanced Cell Technology explains.
You start out with a cell from the patient. You create an embryonic stem cell line, and any replacement cells or organs that you generate are the patient's own cells, so the body will not reject them.
The new method also gets rid of the ethical controversy around using human eggs. From 1998 to 2001, there was virtually no federal funds for this work. And since then, President Bush limited the funds through an executive order. With the money gone, the talent left the field or the country, and so too went a lot of the investors. Now they may be back. George Daly's with the Harvard Stem Cell Institute.
The announcement's probably going to prompt tremendous new enthusiasm and hopefully new investment.
That could foster even greater advances in stem cell biology. But even with today's breakthrough, embryonic stem cells are still years away from curing disease. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Today, French President Nicolas Sarkozy made his first public comments about the transit strike that's disrupted daily life in that country for the past week or so. And he picked a good day to do it, too. Teachers and other civil servants decided to join the picket lines today. Sarkozy said he's not going to negotiate over his plans to reform public sector pensions. The French government figures the strike's costing almost $500 million a day in lost wages and productivity. Labor unrest of another sort is happening elsewhere in Europe. Poland will be hosting the European Soccer Championships in 2012. It's a big deal. So big, in fact, that construction on new roads and stadiums has already started. But the question is, who's going to do the work? Brett Neely reports.
Wrocław is one of six Polish cities that'll host the Games in 2012, and it seems as if the whole place is under construction. New roads, new buildings, new streetcar lines, new highways, not to mention the new stadium. All in all, at least $11 billion worth of infrastructure projects to be completed in 4.5 years, just for one city. Times are good for Polish workers. Adam Bernacek is renovating an old building in the historic city center.
I have more work than last year, three times as much as the year before.
But a nationwide labor shortage could prevent all of that work from being finished on time. As many as 2 million people, roughly 10% of Poland's workforce, have left the country since it joined the European Union in 2004. Many construction workers have landed in Ireland and Britain, where they can work without a visa. They earn as much as six times more in those countries than in Poland. In fact, it's Polish manpower that's building London's Olympic facilities for 2012. The labor shortage is starting to threaten the Polish economy. Andrzej Kubica runs the human resources office for a Polish construction firm.
I can tell you that this year we offered wages that were double those we offered last year.
Even if the stadiums and roads get built on time, there may not be enough workers to staff the city's hotels and restaurants. Until recently, Maciek Buba was the manager of a big restaurant in the center of Wrocław.
For a year, I couldn't hire any chef. Just every one of them is gone somewhere. Nobody answers the advertisements. Nobody comes to work as a chef.
He raised salaries at the restaurant 3 times last year. It didn't help. The solution for now seems to be importing labor. Andre Kubica tells me his construction firm hopes to get several contracts related to the soccer tournament. He's already recruiting workers from the Ukraine and India. He says they'll earn the same as Polish workers, but
these workers from Ukraine and India will cost our company more because we have to pay their living expenses and we have to pay for food.
Poland's government recently made it easier for Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Russians to work in Poland. And last summer, Poland's labor minister went shopping for workers in Asia. On the list, Chinese construction workers who are almost done building next year's Beijing Olympics. It's not just workers who are profiting from the shortage. Marcin Dubaj is one of several entrepreneurs who recruits workers from Belarus and the Ukraine for Polish companies.
Because I was sending a lot of people to work in UK, and I have a lot of friends in Ukraine, and I did have an idea that someone have to fill the gap here, you know.
Working in Poland, he says, is a step up the economic ladder for many Eastern Europeans, in the same way that working in Britain and Ireland is for Poles.
For example, a construction worker is getting in Belarus $200-$300, and here is earning something like $1,000, even more.
Right now, his firm brings in about 100 workers a month, and he expects to hire more as Poland's economy grows and the labor shortages get worse. Foreign workers can provide Poland with the extra muscle it needs to build stadiums and roads, but they won't be able to make up for a bigger loss to Poland's economy. The Polish workers who leave are the country's most entrepreneurial, well-educated, and highly skilled, and more than half say they don't know if they'll return. In Wrocław, Poland, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Coming up, our image of sports fans isn't always a pretty one.
Screaming lunatics, usually shirtless, with their face painted and yelling whooping noises.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street can only keep guessing what the Fed might do or might not do next, and oil prices are heading back into the stratosphere, but the stock market rallied above the 13,000 mark today. The Dow Industrials climbed back in the last hour of trading and ended 51 points higher, 0.4%, 13,010. The Nasdaq tacked on 3 points, 0.1% to close at 2596. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, almost 0.5%, wrapped up the day at 1439. Surging oil prices gave the stock market its late session octane boost. Chevron accelerated more than 3.25%. Stock in ConocoPhillips revved up almost 3%. Nordstrom rang up a 12% gain after the upscale department store chain reported a profit jump and expanded a stock buyback program. Bonds fell. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 4.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Activities are underway in Seoul at the inaugural General Assembly of the World's Toilet Association. The 5-day agenda includes a tour of the world's first toilet house, a house that looks like a toilet. And it's World Hello Day, promoting peace through communication. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We spent most of last week talking with you about the consumer economy, whether or not our buying habits are sustainable. We started Consumed a week ago Friday with an interview I did with Jared Diamond from UCLA. We chose him because of his book, Collapse, about how and why some societies make it and others don't. In our talk, he pointed out that strained natural resources helped push Rwanda to the point of genocide. Environmental policy grad student Joel Larson of Minneapolis heard that and thought we were being a tad simplistic.
Blaming it solely on environmental security prevents a complete understanding so that those of us that care about preventing these events, if we don't understand them completely, we won't be able to help prevent them in the future.
Being green, like much in life, is complicated. Some of you wrote to object to our coverage of a certain company and its boss who's going green, both as the color of the environment and the color of money.
Yeah, this is not an altruistic endeavor.
That was Walmart CEO Lee Scott there. We spent part of last Friday with him in Bentonville talking about the company's plans to mass market green. John Townsley of Okanagan, Washington, said we left out the not-so-green impacts of Walmart's mass manufacturing on the rest of the world.
It didn't really discuss in any depth the awful things that are happening in China in the environment in order to make the cheap things that Walmart sells on its shelves. You don't hear them say that we have environmentally friendly prices. You hear them say that we have low prices.
Low prices and a good ad strategy brings us back to the golden days of marketing. Sarah Gardner showed us how Crisco greased up consumer demand and won the loyalties of her very own mother. Barbara Ruth of New Haven, Connecticut, heard that story while she was doing some baking of her own, and she just had to share a secret from her kitchen.
Your reporter may believe that her mother is just a marketer's dupe, but any pie baker worth her or his salt can tell you the real reason for using vegetable shortening in pie. It makes the flakiest crusts.
Good brands carry stories with them, even though the stories aren't always good. Several of you wrote to point out a commentary about Brand America a couple of weeks ago. Didn't quite shoot straight. We had said a shipment of tainted Tylenol 25 years ago was an example of a brand gone bad. That case in 1982 actually involved product tampering. And any student of corporate public relations can tell you Johnson & Johnson was actually praised for its quick response. If you've got something on your mind, act quickly. Go to our website and click on that link that says contact. It's marketplace.org. If you're one of the umpteen million people who are going to be traveling over the next 3 or 4 days, first of all, we're sorry to hear that. But second of all, if you're not already stressed out, just wait, because there is still time to dial into the upcoming logistical nightmare. Crowded skies, delayed flights, unexpected weather, and traffic jams. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli is here to help with something you might not have thought about.
Plane tickets, hotels, even restaurants. You plan all that out before a trip. But parking is one thing you don't usually bother to think about. People like Tom Lombardi are trying to change that.
All you have to do is to drive into the airport and see the lot that you usually park in full. And panic stricken you, and now you begin to worry whether or not you're going to miss your flight.
Lombardi runs a website where you can reserve a parking spot at 200 lots around the country. He says 50 of the lots he represents sold out a week ago for the Thanksgiving holiday, and already 25 are sold out for Christmas. Supply in many parts of the country simply doesn't match demand.
Seattle is going to have over 200,000 people come through their terminal Tuesday, Wednesday. They have 9,000 parking spaces.
Holidays may be so crazy that off-airport lots sometimes find themselves double-parking cars, but the rest of the year, they have to compete for business. Mark Wildman knows that to most people, a parking space is a parking space. So to entice you to drop your car at one of 35,000 spots his company operates near airports, he has to jazz things up.
Yeah, come on board.
We talked while riding around Los Angeles International Airport on one of his shuttles. It's bright yellow, painted with giant black spots. Parking spot, get it? Wildman knows people's biggest fear about parking off-site is having to wait forever for the ride to and from the airport, so his spotted vans pull out every 5 to 7 minutes. He also throws in free bottled water, cookies for the kids, newspapers, and if you want to pay a little more, valet parking and some other stuff.
You can have your car washed at many of our locations, your car detailed, your oil changed.
Over at the airport itself, you don't get the perks or have to take the shuttle, but the cost of dropping your car can be twice what it is off-site, up to $30 or $40 a day. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
News Corp announced last week it's already sold 95% of the ad space for the Super Bowl broadcast. The game's not even going to happen for another 2.5 months, but Fox says it's getting as much as $2.7 million for a 30-second spot. As we get ready to settle back and enjoy some classic football on Thanksgiving Day, commentator Will Leach says that when it comes to the commercials, you might just want to look away.
It's no secret that the real dollars in sports are made when the game goes to commercial. In fact, the action on the field is simply the filler between hucksters shilling unhealthy sports drinks. If you want to know what advertisers and their clients really think of you, the sports fan, all you need to do is watch any set of commercials during any NFL game. Here's a good example. While his girlfriend gives herself a pregnancy test, a guy discovers that he can determine the coldness of his Coors Light by checking out if the mountains on the bottle have turned blue. He becomes ecstatic and totally indifferent to the positive result of his girlfriend's pregnancy test. A friend of mine once dated an actress who constantly went on commercial auditions for these kinds of ads. She called these roles me or the beer parts. I always lost, she said, and usually, at the end of the commercial, I'd be bonked on the head with something or I'd fall down some stairs. A stray glance at almost any commercial during a sporting event reveals just what cretins these companies and networks consider their consumers to be. Screaming lunatics, usually shirtless, with their face painted and yelling whooping noises. Is this any way to treat a consumer? Is this what they really think of us? Imagine if a financial services company portrayed all its investors in its ads as cocaine-addled, sociopathic Patrick Bateman masters of the universe. Look, the problem is not inherently the sexism or the notion that beer might, you know, taste good. The problem is that these companies don't trust their target audience enough to judge products on their own merits, let alone not to be drooling morons. Contrary to popular opinion, your average fan is not driven solely by the primal needs of sports, beer, and sex. Or, for that matter, whether or not his beer is sufficiently cold. So, enjoy the football this Thanksgiving. And if you know what's good for you, TiVo pass the ads.
Will Leach is the editor of the sports website Deadspin. His upcoming book is called God Save the Fan.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, San Francisco officials have launched a new campaign about heart-clogging cooking oil. They want all of it. The city started what's being called SF Grease Cycle today. It's a program that hopes to collect all the cooking grease from city restaurants and recycle it into biodiesel. Then the hope is that eventually that biodiesel will be used to power all city-owned vehicles. Also, it might help alleviate the $3.5 million that San Francisco spends every year to clean up after polluting restaurants. And that is a grease-free marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 51 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose 3 points. That's 0.1%. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 0.5%. All of that done in a late-day surge. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, old-style French cooking lacks a certain charm.
It's food with a moustache. Too rude and masculine.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.